some people, I think, have said that in listening to my pieces, they're very aware of how they are listening, not just listening. You hear a Beethoven piano sonata, you're just listening to it. Beethoven takes you everywhere in his music. Whereas mine is such that you have to think about how you're perceiving it. A lot of my pieces reveal sounds that are there that you never heard. Echoes, for example, alpha waves, resonances in a room. They reveal these things that are implicit, but you never hear them exactly. You don't pay attention to them. Anyway, it's hard to hear them. I expect people to listen carefully and to throw out any preconceptions that distract. I don't think they need to think about music, about contrast, about meaning. There's no meaning. There's no meaning separate from what it is. I invite audiences to really listen to the phenomena and to really try to hear what I'm doing. Hear the echoes, hear the presences in a room and so forth. I have this little piece called Music for Piano with Magnetic Strings. You simply have four or five ebows, and you put them on the strings of the piano, and the piano sounds. I was performing this in England with some students. They put an ebow on a string, then they would push it to try to get it to sound. I said, no, wait. They tried to make it happen. They were nervous. I said, wait, just let it happen. Took 20, 30 seconds, maybe a minute, and the string would start sounding. Well, that anticipation and that threshold is very important to the structure of that piece. It's not just making it happen, it's letting it happen. It's more important than making it happen. My piece, Music for Solo Performer from Brainwaves, I learned doing that from that piece. You have to sit silent, you have to be quiet. You don't move to make that piece happen. So you have to let it happen instead of make it happen. I'm interested in that phenomenon more than I'm interested in pushing sounds around. That came from Cage and Morton Feldman too. Feldman would write a piece where you could tell he was just intuitively choosing sounds. He never erased anything. He would cross out his score. He never erase and change. It's a beautiful moment in his string piece, string, that long 5-hour quartet, where I could hear little awkwardnesses of voicing, which if you were Rimsky, Rimsky-Korsakov changed Mussorgsky's harmony. He thought it was wrong. There's a little moment in the Feldman piece, the little octaves, they're a little awkward in conventional terms. But he accepted that. You hear it and it becomes beautiful. It becomes something that you listen for. it's not awkward, but just this little octave that is beautiful in the context of his piece. But you think about it. That's a beautiful idea that you get from Feldman. John Cage, too, letting chance operations let something happen that you wouldn't, maybe something you wouldn't like. I remember Pierre Boulez, in one of his pieces, he used this total serial technique. And at a certain moment, a triad occurs. And he has to he can't allow that to happen, so he has to change it. I should say to him, you should let that happen. That's part of this structure you've chosen. So a triad occurs, so what? Why do you have to hide that when it's a natural moment in your system? Of course, any musician has to listen to what they're playing. But I think, say something like Brian Ferdio, for example, very complicated music, or Stockhausen, sometimes the gestures are more important than the individual tones, the overall, you know. In my pieces where I simplify everything, the sounds are very transparent, they're very dangerous there. Hanging out by themselves. You can't hide the sounds in a way that you can in serial music. For example, you can make mistakes and it doesn't change the music that much. You know what I'm saying? Whereas in my work, for example, the clarinet has to really sustain that pitch for a minute. And pay more attention to what the sound is doing. Curious, traditional music, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, you never hear them talking about the spaces that their music is played in. That idea didn't exist in those, I don't think. I mean, Beethoven must have been very clear about where his pieces were played. You know the old idea, if you're writing chamber music for dry spaces, you can be more complex than orchestral music in large spaces. But I don't see where they took that into account at all. I mean, Beethoven's orchestral works are complex. I was thinking about that. They never talked about that. I was a choral conductor for a while, and I was very careful about the tempo that you take a piece in what space. You can rehearse a Bach cantata at one tempo. You go into a place where it's totally different. If the room is reverberant, you have to slow it down a little bit so you hear the complexity. If the room is dry, you can play it a little faster. That idea about space impinging its quality, at least on your performance. I wrote a piece called Exploration of the House for Orchestra, Beethoven had written a piece called Consecration of the House. He wrote a piece for the reopening of a theater in Vienna. And I took that music note by note, have an orchestra play it, then stop and recycle the sounds as in I'm sitting in a room into the space. You can hear what the room does to the orchestral sounds. It's a different use of my idea, but that has to do with the spatial aspects. I was thinking about technology and listening, how they affect one another. I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I remember when I first started making music with electronics, Cambridge was a wonderful city for manufacturing of loudspeakers, KLH and AR loudspeaker system, not to mention Bose, Professor Bose at MIT, inventing the new waveguide system. KLH did a project of commissioning composers to make pieces for their loudspeakers. And I thought they commissioned the wrong people. They weren't thinking carefully. They commissioned good composers, but people who just wrote music, normal music, and their pieces would be played through their loudspeakers. I thought they should commission David Tudor, who was working with loudspeakers. I mean, they should have invited electronic music composers, who the speakers were very important to them, not just as vehicles for producing the music. When I was doing music for Solo Performer for Brainwaves, I was looking at the cone of a KLH loudspeaker. As my alpha waves came through, I could see the speaker cones bouncing, moving. You're not supposed to move cones of a loudspeaker. Actually, it's not good for the cone. But in my case, the alpha waves were such 10 cycles per second, very loud and vivid and bursting. It was causing these loudspeakers, the cones, to move. In that sense, my piece is really about loudspeakers and brainwaves. The loudspeakers are not where the music comes out. The loudspeakers are used to resonate percussion, to do work, to do physical work. So it's it's an extension of the idea of the loudspeaker. Thinking about it as acousmatic music. I don't know, the problem I have with that is it's the same old idea of control and mastery of one or two players, sort of calling attention to what they're doing, like conductors. They're like conductors who, conductors anymore. They're people who dominate the players. Even Earl Brown's music, it's a little problematical for me sometimes. Well, yes, conductors telling the player, pointing at players, telling them when to play. I would much rather work hard and try to figure out a way to let the players play according to some other non-controlling force. That little story I told about music with magnetic strings, those players couldn't stand it, that nothing was happening exactly. They started to push it, control. It was their impulse to do that. I understand that impulse, but it's more beautiful for me if you invent a process, you should let it happen. Boulez should have let that triad happen. And I'm sitting in a room, the recording, of course, you don't see me, you just hear me. I could be anywhere. I've been doing the piece live very often now, because Reinhard Oschlegel from Cologne, when he was alive, suggested I do that. I didn't think about doing that. You know, it's wonderful sometimes. People give you ideas from outside. He said, why don't you do a live performance? I said, well, how can I do that? I use tape recorders and live loops, tape loops. Record on one machine, the loop goes across the stage, plays back on another machine. That's how I used to do it then. Then with computers, you have laptops. Computers, you can store the paragraphs of speech in the computer memory and play them back. That's a wonderful way to do it. So I love that idea. Steve Reich liked the original recording on tape. But I like that too. When you play it on tape, you can control everything. When you do it live, you're at the mercy of live performance. Somebody can cough in the audience and make noise, so forth. But there's a nice excitement, I think, in the live performance. You say the text, hear it come back, hear it come back, hear it come back. Each time it's different, but you know it's happening in real time. Something wonderful about real time, isn't there? Yeah, having audience present, of course, presents a noise factor, coughing, sneezing. But you know, what's magical about that process, sometimes a cough will happen, and then by repetition, it goes away. The repetition destroys it somehow. That text out in real time. I just sat down and wrote it. All I wanted to do was to tell the people what I was doing. So that I wasn't hiding anything. When you write serial music, for example, you don't hear the tone rows. You just don't hear them. You hear what they... Whereas, and I'm sitting in a room, I wanted to let the audience know what was happening. Help them understand the process. I remember Robert Ashley wrote a piece for me. I think it was called Fancy Free. Four cassette tape recorders. I'm talking. He gave me a text with some dirty words in it that I didn't like. So it caused me stress to say them. As the players heard any deviation in my speech, they would press the record playback button and rewind the tape. It was a way of making live tape music. And the idea was that everyone has irregularities in their speech. When you talk, you may have an accent, you may stop and think about what you're saying. You may stutter a little bit. So my piece was about stuttering and also the fact that everyone has irregular. I suppose I was doing it to be therapeutic in some way. Means my stutter, which is a problem, doesn't become a problem. It becomes a positive thing. Makes the piece interesting. It's using a failure to be a success somehow. I stutter, but the more I stutter, it's interesting in this piece because the process irons that out.
rwm.macba.cat